Welcome to the after party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturdays.
Hey, yeah, Anna David here with After Party Pod, the podcast all about addiction recovery. Fun stuff. And the thing is, it is fun. I'm not saying that facetiously. And no episode better showcases the fact that it is fun more than this one. I'm super energized. If I was douchey, I would say I'm super pumped. Nothing against any of you who use the word pumped to describe feeling excited and energized. I just finished a conversation with the subject of the interview you're about to listen to. His name is Amos Pizzi. Isn't that a fun name? I hope Amos Pizzi. I feel like I could be saying it wrong, but say it out loud just so you can feel what that's like. It's interesting. Fascinating guy. We first started messaging on Facebook. He read something I wrote and liked it, obviously the quickest way into my heart. But, and then I Googled him, as I am wont to do, and was just, holy shit, that's amazing. So he has lived this amazing life. He is from West London. His mother was the founder of the Women's Refuge Movement. Oh yeah. Erin Pizzi is her name. And when he was 14, he started working with Boy George, and though he kind of tried to almost convince me this is not accurate, he sang on Culture Club's first album. Yeah. Then his family moves to New Mexico, and Do You Really Want to Hurt Me came out right then. And anyway, he was tight with Boy George at that point, so then he came back and got this record deal, and talks all about that and about what happened. Then he became pretty much the most fabulous person in England, which I think kind of makes you the most fabulous person in the world. I don't know. I'm a bit of an Anglophile. He did not say he became the most fabulous person, but he... there's this Guardian article. There's a bunch of pieces about how he was just like running with the crowd. I mean, more than running with the crowd, creating the crowd and living this fabulous life, which was actually, because he was addicted, not quite as fabulous, the opposite of as fabulous as it seemed from the outside. And then he ended up, well, he got married to this uber fabulous woman. She got sober. Then he got sober afterwards. And he is as enthusiastic about being sober as anybody I've come across, and really quite passionate about being able to share what people in recovery and 12-step programs learn with all of humanity, which, as we know, suffers. We're a suffering group. And as they say, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. I don't know, somebody actually said that, and then they repeated it. I'm one of they. Anyway, he's a really happy guy. We're kind of on a run with very happy alcoholics and addicts lately, which God bless them. Anyway, we get into all of that, and he says repeatedly, oh, I'm not smart enough to blah, blah. He's so smart, and sort of talked circles around me, and more quotes than you've ever heard from spiritual leaders, and just really, really inspiring stuff. I have no doubt that you will agree. So with that, I give you Amos Pizzi.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God, I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as right. I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky, because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
So we're super casual.
Absolutely.
So yeah, putting the message out there is
everything.
Is everything, right?
Yeah.
So the So, okay, I will be honest and say that when we spoke, I didn't get the whole breadth of you. I sort of saw Talent House, and I was like, Culture Club, and then I just read that piece in The Guardian from, I think, 2005.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's a really interesting piece.
First of all, it's a million words long.
Yeah.
And second of all, it is literally like I've never read a more fabulous sounding life than the one that you were living.
But you probably know what was behind that. Nature of what we're discussing, because there were it alluded to it.
It did what you said.
The darkness and what was really, you know, everything is highs and lows when you are when I am not sober.
Right.
You know, everything is extremes, and so the dark parts were very, very dark, and I'm very glad that they're not there anymore.
Well, because yes. You actually, of course, 100%. But my life didn't sound as fabulous if you'd written a story. No, literally, it's like all they do is go to amazing places with beautiful people, and every expense is covered. And he's the most charming man who's ever lived, and all he does is like charm you. I mean, it literally was just like.
It was
actually
a really painful line in it, where it said everyone knows, but no one really knows what he does. So I thought that was funny. Look, the thing is, that was a particular period in time, and most importantly, that came out of what we in the UK call Acid House, which is now called EDM here.
Right.
And the house music movement starting in 1988, a club called Shum, and it was another one called Spectrum by Danny Rampling and Nicky Holloway, who went on to become known DJs. That was kind of our 60s. Like, the combination of technology, the Atari and Cubase Audio,
right,
which we started using to make records, which broke the stranglehold of the record companies, because then you didn't need a studio. And much like people yourself now are doing your own broadcasts and your own content. And obviously MDMA,
right,
which made all the English people, because we're moody... I can't swear, can I?
You can swear as much as you want.
All right, so the English people are moody wankers, right? We're all off with each other. We're all VIP. We're all very tribal by nature.
Right.
And MDMA opened us all up, and we started to meet in these huge groups, literally 10 to 20,000 people in fields, all organized by phone calls. It was a real movement, and everybody stopped fighting, including the football hooligans. If you remember when New Order released World in Motion for that World Cup, it was all about ecstasy.
Yeah.
Love
for
the World in Motion. And everyone in England, all the tribes came together through music and helped each other. And these became Cream and the Ministry of Sound, and what you now see EDC, which is Pascal's thing here, they're all the same thing. They all came out of a real desire for connectivity. So I think that article you're talking about, that was written at the tail end when we'd all become kind of DJ superstars, and we'd all discovered Blow and started becoming idiots again, and it would all became, that article was about elitism, the Mo, the Bar, I had the Met Bar and the A-list. And,
I know, that's why it was so appealing to this really sick part of me.
No, of course, to all of us. Come on, exclusivity and the desire to be in begins when you're a child. It's pack, right? It's
like, I guess so, but yeah. I was just like, well, why didn't I know him then? I lived in England. I lived in England in college.
Where did you live?
I lived in Cambridge.
Wow, that's pretty. That's like country and big. When did you go to college?
Well, I went to a school called Trinity in... No, but not the one
that
at...
Trinity.
Yeah.
No,
like, I went to a far less exclusive Trinity in Connecticut.
Okay.
And then I did a junior year abroad, as people do.
Yeah.
And I went to a school in Cambridge... that I, if I'm talking to a non-British person, I'll try to pass off like, oh, I went to Cambridge.
Right.
But the truth is, it was an American school that hired Cambridge tutors.
It's still beautiful. Like,
yeah, I loved it.
And you were studying writing.
I was studying writing, and it was, the Dark Ages, and it was England, so I wrote my stories by hand.
I love it. I love it. I mean, there's a real cognitive neuroscience link between writing. So I'm dyslexic, and I can barely write. I also left school at 10. So, which, by the way, both my kids are in formal education. I'm a huge supporter of the system. But my mother writes 3,000 to 4,000 words in longhand every morning. She's done it since I was a kid. And I asked her why when I was little, because it's just free flow.
Yeah.
And she said, because I'm a writer. So you have to practice. It's like doing scales. I played instruments. You have to practice.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that the process of actually physically writing is very different to typing or... certainly to what we do now, shorthand and dictating.
And texting and all that stuff.
Yeah, because it's flowing from you.
You know, that's interesting, because I will say step work is the only kind of writing that I do by hand.
There you go. And then, it's funny, I had a series of sponsors, but I had one that I quit because I was too weak, because he was like, you have to write 300 words on the principle of each step before we start. And I said, okay, I'll type it, because I can't, I am dyslexic, like, I can barely write.
But isn't it just as hard to type as it is to write?
No, because you've got spell check, plus you've learned through practice, I've learned how to do it. Habit. And he said, no, you have to write it longhand. And I was like, why? And he said, because that's how it works. And I was just doing some fist step work with a guy yesterday.
Yeah.
And he's the most thorough fist step I've ever seen. But he was bemoaning it. We're in the middle. And he's like, God, you know. And I was like, okay, but neuro-linguistic programming, which is what step work is, right?
Yeah.
It's effectively reprogramming your mind through repetition.
Yeah.
You know, there's certain things we say, there's certain ways we behave. And it's that great saying, you can't think your way into right acting,
yeah,
but you can act your way into right thinking.
Yeah.
All of that is the same as sports psychology. It's all the same thing, right? As you visualize what you're going to become,
right,
you repeat an exercise, sprinting,
right,
punching, tennis stroke thousands of times,
right,
so it becomes default. So when you're placed under pressure for your sobriety, which we are, there's a default position. And the thing is that thorough step work is really the key. I mean, you're ahead of me on this. It's
how do you
not
know?
I know.
Oh, because
I've
hand-wrote?
I read all the stuff you write. I know exactly where you are. You said something that I used yesterday.
Oh, what?
It's the human condition.
Yeah.
That's what people miss. It's not, okay, it's exacerbated in us due to our predilection for alcohol and drugs.
Absolutely.
But you're right, it's the human condition. Obsession,
yeah,
self-obsession, selfishness. That's how people are.
Yeah,
but
and fear.
Well, see, guys, that's a great conversation. It's all fear, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's all it is.
All of it.
It's just,
you know, because I'm on my, you know, 10 millionth time through the steps. That's not true. It's
no,
probably
it's
my
good.
Seventh.
You're
I don't
very
know.
Active in it, I know.
I wouldn't say that's necessarily true. And I never, ever want to look like I'm saying I've got the answers.
But you don't. That doesn't come across
okay,
in the way
good.
You speak. I think there's a lot of humor to how you write. I think it's a very
thank
important
you.
Factor.
I think it's so key.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, and that was the whole goal with starting the site is, you know, we're talking about life and death, but we don't have to talk about it like
absolutely.
It's life and death, you
absolutely.
Know? Because you can't reach the masses. You cannot make it approachable to people.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make people want to do it
mm-hmm.
if you're just being sort of sanctimonious and serious.
Absolutely.
So, but my point was, oh, yeah, yeah. So the defect I'm currently praying about is just fear. Because insecurity is fear.
It's all fear.
Because trying to control people is fear.
It's all fear. It's... I heard a guy speak once and he said, I haven't taken a fearful breath in 5 years. He was a great speaker. So I went up to him afterwards and said, Tim, how do you do that?
Yeah.
I said, look, you know, I go, I think, let me get this right. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over, right? Step three.
Yeah.
That's the hardest one.
Oh,
because
yeah.
that's the one you have to keep going back to because it happens every day, right?
Every minute.
It's like, wait.
Yeah.
You know? So I kind of got this down to, we were talking about this yesterday. It's great we're having this conversation now because it's so fresh.
Yeah.
Really, okay, if you distill it, and I like to do that because I'm control freak,
yeah.
I'm like, where's the essence?
Yeah.
So for me, the essence of the 12-step program is I control nothing except my response to my reaction to everything. So my reaction is midbrain, fight,
absolutely.
Fuck, flee, feed, sleep. It's millions of years old. It's never going to go away. Someone jumps through the door now, we're going to go like this.
Right.
But my response is cortex, right? It's less than 120,000 years old. Architecture, empathy, compassion, reason. I can condition my cortex to see my midbrain reaction and
right.
look at it before I do anything. So,
right.
we are training the pause. And
yeah.
the pause is where God is.
Yeah.
The stillness, right? Because long after I'm here, there'll be this stillness. It's here now. I'm just talking to it. It's
yeah.
here all the time, right?
Right.
So, this is why we're so drawn to yoga and all these other things that
right.
link into this thing. That, and I believe it's why we look for oblivion. We were trying to find the stillness, the gap.
Right.
The quiet,
right.
you know,
right.
I'm higher, I'm there.
Right.
But that's unconscious enlightenment. So, if the essence is conditioning this pause, then the whole essence, you're absolutely right. Let me just follow this thought through. It's conditioning yourself to respond to fear.
Yeah.
That's it. That's it.
I know. It's so... But then there's biochemistry, which is different.
Totally different. And if this links to depression and other things, okay.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Because so like last night, say,
yeah.
I was meeting a friend for dinner.
Mm.
Not a sober, just a friend.
Mm.
And we were supposed to meet at 8.
Mm-hmm.
And then she emails me and says, how about 8:30? And I said, no big deal. Then she calls me and she says, well, the truth is I'm meeting an old college roommate for an hour before. Can we make it 8:45? And I suddenly feel, not even consciously, slighted. Oh, you're just fitting me in.
It doesn't go back to fear.
It does.
You're not enough and you won't be loved.
Yes.
Fundamental two fears of all humans. Yeah.
Yes. So then I am... get to the restaurant at 8:45 and she's late. She gets there at night. She told me she's made a reservation. There's no reservation. So it's like this one thing after another. I'm completely fine. I'm sort of congratulating myself on like how well adjusted I am. We sit down and then she looks up and she goes, oh my God, that's my old boss. I'm going to go say hi. And to my brain, she was gone 20 minutes.
Right. How long was she really gone?
I didn't time it. She claims it was like a minute.
Did you have a healthy confrontation with
her? No, not at all. And it's weird because I was like, it doesn't matter. This doesn't mean anything. And I reacted. Well, okay.
How did you react?
Then she came back and I go, oh my God, that was a long time or something like that. And she goes, it was just a minute. And plus that was really important. And so I had expected, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it sounds like, okay, so again, I need to stay out of any judgment here because it's but it sounds like in the first place, it would have been a really good idea or suggestion to say, hey, I have this time with you.
Yeah.
Time was our most important commodity. For example, when I came in, I turned off my phone because I respect you because we're sitting there to have this conversation.
Yeah.
Let's have this time together.
Yeah.
That's one way of doing it. And then the ball is in her court to go, okay, I hear you and I should respond to that.
Right.
Sounds like she had time boundary issues, right?
Which is, but also,
we're friends, we'll see each other anyway, don't worry about it.
Right.
But I think you have a reasonable position there, which is I've taken this time to be with you.
A reasonable position, but that doesn't make my reaction.
Do you think that's biochemistry?
I wonder.
Right.
I wonder.
Do you suffer from depression?
Oh yeah, and I'm medicated. And
yeah, of course. Here's the thing. This is a much bigger thing.
Yeah.
I've family experience with this.
Yeah.
You know, the dual diagnosis thing, I think, is one of the big problems in the room, is that people get sober, but if you... So somebody close to me is diagnosed with depression, and in this situation, I'm saying I'm going to speak for them, they're not here. But when that happened, they were struggling with sobriety, and they could not stay sober. I understand it now, because you get physically sober, but you're depressed.
Yeah.
That must be, like, awful.
You've never had that?
I'm not... Depression's not my thing. I'm a common or garden alcoholic. I'm an egotistical maniac, and I definitely have the fear thing.
Right.
That drives me, and it's far more alpha in me. I'm very aggressive about it, and driven, and buildings, and, you know, but the truth is that just makes me completely full of shit, you know, because if you strip it all down, everything that I've done, including the article you began this interview talking about, isn't me. Like, I'm aware of that. I happen to be aligned to energy in moments, and that energy moves because I can't write very well, because I didn't go to school, because of all these things. And I'm a copywriter, right? I write lyrics, and all this stuff has to be... I always knew there had to be something bigger than me. It's not, you know, I made music. It's music comes out of the air. I mean, you hear it in your head, right? So even then, I was like, this, even though you train it and you hone the ability to produce and write, it doesn't mean shit. The actual stuff, like when you have a hit, where'd it come from? It's not here, you know, where's it come from? So the same thing, I'm sure, with your storytelling. When you're in flow with Party Girl, where's the character? I know it's, but it starts to come through you.
Yeah.
Right. So no, I don't have depression, and I think that for those of us, and many of us in the rooms do,
that's why it's surprising to me. I mean, you don't seem remotely depressed, of course, but there are very few people, even who've come on this podcast, who don't. I mean, I'm going to make up a statistic. Yeah. I'm going to say 2/3.
I'd be with you, but think about
3/4, maybe.
What we're dealing with when we go to get sober is trauma, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is, trauma. Everyone thinks about trauma. They think about post-traumatic stress disorder, and they think about Vietnam.
Yeah.
PTSD is I was picked up too much, I was left alone, I was loved, I wasn't loved, I was hit, I didn't get hit, someone paid, whatever it is, especially as a parent, I know there's an imbalance.
Yes.
Now, the extremity of the imbalance is the extremity of the trauma. So if you have the shit beaten out of you, that's extremely traumatic. If you were abandoned and not spoken to and left to raise yourself, and it is my belief that when we use, we shut off cortex and we go to midbrain,
right?
start, that's why it's gradual.
Yeah.
I mean, I always follow the same process. When I used to drink, I was very funny.
Yeah.
I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
Really loud.
Yeah.
And I had lots of people around me.
Yeah.
Then I told everyone what to do and how I knew the world should run. Then I got either aggressive or sexual, uh-huh. and then I started crying. That's probably a 12 or 13 hour process.
Really?
Yeah, you're like, yeah! Then you're like, I know exactly what's wrong with the world. Then you're like, hey, baby. Then you're like, oh, no one understands me. Again and again and again, because it's all this. Right.
Limbic.
Yeah.
Limbic.
That's a much better term for
it. No, that's what it is. Yeah, what's fascinating to me is that I started to get this degree at UCLA in like addiction studies, and I kind of dropped out. But that's exactly what they talk about: is what the neocortex and the limbic.
Because you're shutting it down. The more we drink, the more you've seen all this. Because I've done all this as well in the various treatment centers I was in with various people. It explained to me. I'm a pretty simple guy, so they're like, "Look, you turn this off.
Yeah.
Gradually, you get higher and higher till you're just here. So when you wrote so brilliantly about being at the computer and not being able to move.
Oh,
I've had that experience a lot where you're like, I'm going to write something great, rushing, outline, sit there, and then what happens is you think, then you end up like, literally, I can't fucking move, there's a sound. Because you're just here, fight, fight, please, fight, 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 like that, you know what I mean? Faster, faster, faster. So you end up where you see our beautiful brothers and sisters who are addicted to crack cocaine or meth, they're just literally going like a hamster on a wheel.
Yeah.
And I want to be very clear, it's probably going to sound strange, I'm not anti-drugs or alcohol, I'm anti-pain.
Me too. Yeah,
I got
I'm
no
really
issue.
With you.
But I think that for me, I don't have, I'm not doing it because I want to have a nice glass of wine, I'm doing it because I want to obliterate myself and stop thinking and feeling.
Yeah.
And the gift for me, I think I said this to you when we spoke, after the birth of my daughter and my son, sobriety is the greatest thing I've been given. Not sobriety, the 12-step program.
Yeah.
American enlightenment, right?
So, okay, so talk to me. So how did you, so you went to many treatment centers?
No, I never went. Just the thing, I went to help other people. Okay, it's very long, so you're going to cut all this up.
I'm not, because every bit of it's fascinating. Okay.
So long, I hope you're not, I'm not making some kind of sense.
It's, I'm fascinated. Go on.
So I have a 17-year-old son, stepson, I raised since he was about 2.5, and a 12-year-old daughter. When my daughter was about 3 or 4 months old, so it's a long time ago, I stopped using drugs. I had an epiphany moment. I was working on a record with a Moby, great record, a gospel-based record, and I'd been out for days doing our usual thing in clubs. Yeah, coke, E, everything, whatever it was, right? We were everything people, but yes. And I always drank. Right, and so anyway, I came in and I saw my 3-month-old child who was with a nanny, and it was a beautiful morning, and I hadn't been to bed. Remember those days?
Yeah.
And I had an epiphany. I realized that she was an angel. I realized that why Renaissance paintings use babies, because they're just there, they're totally pure, and whatever I do is going to be reflected directly towards her and who she becomes. So I stopped using drugs, but I continued to drink for many years. And I was a very controlled alcoholic. Mm-hmm. I love the term high bottom drunk. I don't know why there isn't a band called that. It's such a wicked term.
When I was new, I heard about a girl who had a band called Dr. Bob's Nightmare.
That's kind of cool.
Isn't that great?
I just think high bottom drunk is such a cool t-shirt.
Yeah, for
So that was me. So basically, I drank for years. It coincided. It was interestingly easy for me to stop doing drugs. I had enough. And I was at the point, certainly with cocaine, where it was uncomfortable. I don't know what your experience is, but everything that I've started, I smoked weed when I was a kid for years, and by the end I was just paranoid. And the same thing with coke. For the first 6 years it was funny.
Yeah.
And the last 4, your face went weird, you didn't know where you were, and you would like the thing at the computer.
Yeah.
And that happened more and more and more.
Oh, then it happened
all
every
the time. Then that's all that happened. So
that's
the same thing that by the time I stopped drinking was happening with drinking, is I'd have a few drinks and I'd be hammered. And I'd be like, and I now know that this is a progressive disease. Liver.
Yeah.
You got it. And then I wouldn't know what I was doing. So that took a long time. So I managed, or was recruited, in the middle of club culture and all the stuff that you were reading about, and you know, EDM and what we were doing. I was. This is the sort of God thing for me, the luck thing, if you want, or destiny. I was brought in by a guy who had become the CEO of Saatchi & Saatchi in London, big agency worldwide. And he came and found me, actually in the Met Bar of all places, which was a hedonistic place, and said, you know, I'm going to take over this agency and we need youth market, and that's what you do, because I had TV shows running and various things and hit records and stuff that we did. It was a collective of us. And so I got into the agency, and how this is relevant is when they built my building for me, which was like this big, it was an amazing job, and they were like, what do you want? I never had a job, right?
God,
I was like, I'd like 20-foot speakers. They were like, sure.
Oh, wow.
I had like a glass thing. And they built, so it was great.
Oh my God.
I had a bar belt in my office with a barman.
Why not?
It was so cool. Yeah. He was over there and he was, you know, it was like people, clients would come in, I'd be with Procter & Gamble, like, him would like a drink, you know.
Yeah.
And it was great. So in that culture, alcohol was very celebrated.
Yeah.
A lot. And what happened is, just to sort of bring this up to a point, I drank for many years and I came up with the concept of creating the world's creative department. So doing what we did in the agency, but doing it online and letting people in Russia and India and trying to putting up creative briefs and having a creative community respond with work, which is really what Talent House is.
Yeah.
Right? It's the world's creative department. And that was kind of what I was brought in there to figure out, how to connect with the internet audience, how to reach more talent, how to... And so I presented it to Saatchi, who were a great company, and they said, in fairness, it's going to take a long time and cost a lot of money. They were right.
Yeah.
They also said it needs to be on the West Coast. So I raised capital, which was tricky because I had no idea what I was doing,
yeah.
which took a couple of years. And by the time I'd done it, we'd sold all our properties and all my right. cars, and it was real rough. It was good.
Oh, so you put yourself...
Oh, no.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
so the Saatchi thing, you weren't doing it anymore?
I left to do this.
Okay.
Yeah, I was an equity partner, actually, in their content division. It was
right.
a big move. But in fairness, also, the CEO is leaving, and he's a great friend of mine and a mentor. He still is. And, you know, I wanted to be... We had a good time there. I learned a lot there. But what's relevant to how and why I stopped drinking is I then took on this thing of building Talent House,
right?
Which is a lot bigger than me, right? It's not like I'm just a tiny part of getting this thing going. There's a lot of people working on it. We have a division in India with Reliance,
wow.
With Talent House India running in Mumbai. We're just about to launch it in Germany with ProSieben, which is like NBC Germany, and they've invested. And we're talking in the Middle East, and I'm going to China, and then we're dealing with these fantastic. Groups, you know, the Twitters and Illuminations of this world, fantastic companies, lots of them, 50
yeah.
of them, Fortune
wow.
500 companies. And so, to answer your question, it's such a
what was my
way.
Question?
Okay, why and how were I in treatment centers?
Yes.
No, I got to a point, and I'm sure people understand this who have got sober, where I realized that I couldn't do both things. Like, I couldn't honor the connectivity with what I perceive as God, which is energy.
Right.
And move. See, we're powerless, but we're connected to all power at
right.
all times. This is how you can do absolutely anything.
Right.
Start a revolution, change a government, you know, save 1,000 lives. This is how, because you look at people, how did you do that? They did it.
Right.
They did it because they plugged in. Mother Teresa plugged into
yeah.
primal, right?
Yeah.
And she just started. And my mother, obviously, I saw her do it. I saw her change the world, save thousands of lives, change laws. Fought Margaret Thatcher, jailed, pardoned, out of jail, just amazing. So I had that osmosis of seeing it happen. So I got sober to respect what it was I was trying to build, because
yeah.
it was disrespectful to be hungover, and it was disrespectful to be talking bullshit in a club at 3 in the morning. I've done it anyway, I'm sure, like, thousands of times.
But that's so interesting.
Yeah.
So, because again,
yeah.
this goes with you're not suffering from depression,
mm-hmm.
whereas I think most people get sober because they sort of get suicidal or
yes.
whatever it is. But
yeah.
it's like you knew the whole time. For you to have that awareness,
right.
that to honor what I'm trying to build, I have to be connected, and I can't really be connected if I'm high on drugs.
Well, what's beautiful about what you just said is it makes me sound like Buddha. Let me be clear. If you go back 10 years before that, when that article was
yeah.
that you're talking about, it was in the Telegraph, the article on bleaching, I had all the things you were talking about. At that point, I did an awful lot of Class A's, and I had tremendous angst and suicidal
right.
thoughts, and
okay.
also, as you read in the article, my nephew, my little brother,
yeah.
committed suicide, which is why I built Talent House. You see how it works. He was an artist who could get through. And in that period, which was right when the article was written, I think it just happened, I was very destructive. Like, I woke
right.
up in hospitals and it's amazing talking about this now. I had no idea. Like, I remember waking up in a hospital on a drip and being like, where am I? And they were like, you know, you've done X, Y, Z, you were found here. And I was like, okay, I'm gone. Pull
yeah.
the stuff out of my arm, get
yeah.
up, walk out. And literally within an hour, be doing it again.
Yeah.
So I understand definitely the self-destruct.
Yeah.
And it's exacerbated so much by cocaine. Like, it's such a
God,
dark
it's such
thing.
An evil drug.
Horrible.
You never shot it or anything, though?
Just no, no, only because... Again, I don't want to sound like... I don't think there's any separation between the crackhead and the lawyer who's an alcoholic.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's just where and how you're doing it. I,
yeah.
for example, convinced myself for many years, you know, I'll drink Chateau Lafite, and it's the same thing.
Yeah.
What's the difference? At
yeah.
the end of the day, I'm trying to switch off my cortex
yeah.
and get to midbrain
yeah.
and act pretty much in an animal state, which
yeah.
is where you see all the sexual behavior when people are high, which just... I mean, it's not a big thing, is to find balance when you're sober. You mentioned in one
yeah.
of the things, it's really funny being single for like years since you got sober.
Let's not get depressing. Oh yeah,
I don't think it's depressing. I think that you could do some work on that.
Oh,
look,
I do.
You're a beautiful woman. I don't think that it's you. It's not, you know what I mean?
But it's also
yeah.
the truth
Tell
is with that is that, you know, I have some standards. You know, the whole thing about the road getting narrower is that, and I'm very independent. Like, I'm much happier on my own than I would be
Fair.
Selling out the way a lot of people see.
Very
you.
Big point, and almost a completely different thing, because
yeah.
there's a whole culture which is very strong in LA of what I call the deal. It's like, there's this woman and this guy, and she's done this to be in this place, and he's
yeah.
going to provide you with this, and then you know, it's such a... I love this city. There's so many great things.
I agree.
There. Creative energy.
Yeah.
You know, and also everyone's an immigrant, right? Virtually no one's from
yeah.
here. So
yeah.
on the other hand, because of the entertainment industry, the good stuff is the creativity, and the bad stuff is that it's a very chauvinistic, male-driven... Thousands of young women coming through.
And
it, you
materialistic.
Know?
It's like I was set up on a date. A friend set me up on a date with a guy who had his own plane. Like, I remember I was going to New York that weekend. He said, "You can come on my plane." And not only did I not go on the plane, I didn't go to a movie with him when he asked me later. I was like, I'm so phenomenally not attracted to this guy, and I don't know how to do that thing
you
that I think...
Okay, but that's because you're well. I mean, the thing is, that's because you're well.
I wish I was less well. I wish
that
I could have taken that ride.
You know
on
what people
plane.
Say? That my wife telling me, because she obviously was in media for a long time, and she had a lot of those sort of situations, and she's like, yeah, she's like, I can't do that if
yeah.
I don't... But I just think that's really well balanced. I think that's something to celebrate. And
it
know,
is. It
yeah.
is. But it's unfortunate that in our society, it's considered like, what's wrong with that girl?
Maybe
as opposed
only
to
in
what's
a part of
right
society you're
that
talking
girl.
About. It's only a part of society. I think
I
you'll know. Find that real, genuine people are awake and connected.
Yeah.
Our purpose in life is to connect, right?
Yeah.
It's what you do so well. It's what you're doing
Thank
this
you.
For.
Thank you.
And that's what you're doing here, right?
Yeah.
And so... your primary connection of it and God is with the person that you love and make love with.
Yeah.
And this is a serious thing. And by the way, I had very little understanding of this before I got sober.
But you, but you're still with you. But you got married before you got
oh,
sober.
Oh yeah, we went through. We were crazy.
Did you get sober together?
Different times. She got sober before me, and
uh-huh.
she had a, I think maybe a rougher time. But she's an amazing human being, and she's energy. You know, she's
yeah.
she also. Professionally in her career was responsible for signing a lot of major artists and helping change the radio system in the UK and get bands like Prodigy and JK playing. So she is talented.
Yeah.
She's always been that person. She's always, Lisa's connected to loads of musicians and artists and photographers and she, that's her thing. So she and I are so naturally kind of
you,
aligned.
The same, yeah.
yeah.
And so when she was sober and you were not, was that, what
was
that
like?
That was
a nightmare. It's really good you raised that. Well, I didn't understand
yeah.
sobriety or the
yeah.
12-step thing, so I was drinking. But you see, like I said, very controlled. So
right.
I'm a guy.
You thought you were fine.
Oh, of course I did. I thought
yeah.
it was great.
Yeah.
No, I thought it was really a great guy.
Yeah.
And I sit there, I thought, I was like, I'm not doing drugs now.
Right.
So here you go. And I bet you don't miss drinking either. Right, you go sit down. That's horrible. Looking back at it now that I've had some awareness and exposure to the 12 steps, first thing is you got to remove all that stuff from around you. So, but I genuinely... You know, do you not think sometimes when you talk to people about steps, it's like talking to someone in Japanese when they don't speak Japanese? One of the problems
yeah.
with me is once I have knowledge, I assume other people have it.
Right,
right.
I think I do the same
Huge.
Thing.
We all do it.
Yeah.
I was taught it at the agency. My ex-boss was like, you know, you walk into a room and you start talking. They don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Stop.
Yeah.
What is it I'm trying to say? So, again, if you look at America... And I love America.
Yeah.
The best and the worst of it's the most amazing place for a lot of serious reasons. It's not a flippant thing to say. But basically, it's self-made, right? It's very
yeah.
young. Everybody built everything by hand.
Yeah.
And the art of it, or the essence of it that I see from the outside, is that they make incredibly complicated things simple and they work. So I know the Senate may not seem simple, but it's the most effective form of democracy devised, right?
Right.
Something started thousands of years ago, and it, you know, it is what it is, or capitalism, or banking, or
right.
technology in Silicon Valley, or the movie industry. It's the American thing. Take something, figure it out, make it work.
Yeah.
So when I look at the 12-step program, having spent probably 15 or 20 years with Taoism and Zen Buddhism, I have a long history with the whole martial arts thing, I see the same thing, that he managed to take something that you could do in literally, if you do it hard, 12 months, and the transformation,
you could do it in a day. That's what they did in the
big
old days.
Big review. So yeah. I'm a guy that does 1, 2, and 3 with someone at a table in an hour.
Yeah.
Give me 5 examples of one.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And then I'm like, step 4, let's go.
That's what I think. I don't know if you ever saw that movie, Clean and Sober.
Yeah, I loved it.
Such a good movie.
Loved that movie. I watched it again the other night.
Such a great premise.
The Michael Keaton movie, right?
Yes, it's such a great premise. But it's like, let's get a guy who's hiding out in rehab and show that, I mean, what a message, that like, if you're hiding out in rehab, you're going to learn about a new way of living and you're going to get well. I mean, it's so good. But the way that, like, he starts doing the steps, he meets with his sponsor and he goes, sponsor, the first thing he says is, you're going to make a list of all the people you resent.
I'm with you. And by the way, so this is a good tangent, right? It's I'm loving this conversation.
Yeah.
That is... I've got to be very careful. I have very little authority here. Do you know what I mean?
None of us have.
But I don't agree with the okay. Do you know this whole story about rehabs, right? There was a 90% or 95% success rate with Bill and Bob, right? It was everybody got it, right? And remember these guys, they were waking them up in sanatoriums on a bed. They're about to die. It's like, do you want this now? And the ones that were like, yeah, they did the steps in 7 days, as I understood it, to 2 weeks. That was it. And then they carried on straight into service. Right, so then I was told, and this is probably convoluted, that the overflow and the build led to treatment centres where people would, because they couldn't deal with that many people. And I know the original ones, like Hazeldene, are really hardcore, and I'm pro a lot of rehab. I think if you cannot get a day, it's a really good idea to go somewhere for a month, and have stability and structure and understanding.
Yeah,
but what I really don't understand is how you can spend 90 days somewhere and not do step 1, 2, 3, and 4. You come out, I don't understand what you... It's like, I don't understand the idea of spending 2 years doing the steps. Because surely, the essence is in 4 and 5, right? 1, 2, and 3 are decisions.
Well, yeah.
4 and 5 are written.
Let's say through 9.
That's what I was going to say, hold on. And then 6 and 7 are decisions, and 8 and 9 are actions.
Yeah.
So 4, 5, 8, and 9 with... Let me get this right, so I'm not getting this wrong. A permanent amends is 10 every day.
Regular.
Constant contact, which I'm on. And then
constant contact is 11.
That's right. So 10 is basically 11 amends.
Every day. Tracking.
What have we done wrong?
Yeah.
Like, all right, and then what are you doing? Sponsoring.
Yeah.
All right, and as soon as we're sponsoring, which really for me is what keeps me in it.
Yeah.
Like I had to sit down and go over it with someone and take their calls and listen to what they're saying. And it helps to prevent me from being an arsehole. Because when I'm saying you shouldn't do this,
right,
we don't lie, I can't lie as I want to all the time.
Right.
I'm like, okay. And this then bleeds into everything, right? Your personal relationships, your relationships with men and women, your relationship with your kids, your relationship with your business. And so American Enlightenment, you know, that's what I think. That's why you and I were talking about whether there was a way to make something like this that explained it, because no one knows.
I know. I mean, like, I don't know about you, but I had been given rules for living that were very different from the rules that I saw on a banner when I first walked into the rooms. And they were revolutionary. It was like, what? I'm this miserable because I think about myself all the time? Mm-hmm. I'm going to feel like, when I'm mad, I need to look at my part. Like, it was revolutionary. And yes, everyone can benefit from it. Oh, but what I was going to say also, this kind of ties in, is, you know, the low bottom and then the 95% success rate, 12-step had, 100 people in it?
Yeah, you're right.
So when you open it up to millions of people,
you're absolutely right.
They're going to be way...
And there's another thing we
more
should throw
people
in
that
there.
Can't.
You know, rarely have we never seen, and the great saying that he would only change one word in the book, which was to...
What was the word?
So, rarely have we seen a person fail. And
who has
thoroughly followed this path. Only those poor and fortunate who are incapable of being rigorous and self-honest, right?
Yeah.
So the thing is, apparently Bill Wilson said on his deathbed he would change it to never. So I want to add to that. No, it makes sense. I've never seen anybody go through the steps and practice them and relapse. But I've seen loads of people, the majority, just not do them.
Yeah.
That's 4 or 5 and stop.
Yeah.
Or don't do anything.
Sure,
right? Yeah. So that's done. You're basically going to be able to not drink for a period of time, and then something's going to happen. You're going to lose, right?
Right.
Or do what I feel is always far more likely to me is to practice it and then practice it in reverse. Because, you know, if you look at relapse, you go backwards. If you go from step 12, sought to help others,
yeah,
then prayer and constant contact, then you stop taking a daily amends,
yeah,
you go backwards.
You end up taking your power back in step one, I'm not powerless.
That's the moment before you drink. I got this, right? So what I'm saying is, I think what he meant is if you are thoroughly following and living inside this philosophy, is very... I don't, thank you God, and I mean this, have the desire to drink.
Yeah.
And I've had deaths, and I've had all the stuff that we've had. It doesn't happen. And that, I want to stress to anyone who's listening to this, is a miracle, because I could not get 24 hours.
Right.
I could build companies and box 10 rounds and do all the things I've done in my life, and, you know, but I couldn't get 24 hours on my own.
Right.
So it's not me.
And I've had the same experience, and I hate the word miracle, sounds so
cheesy. No, it's good, and it's why you're here, and it's why you're doing this, right?
It doesn't make any sense. And when, you know, people were like, you know, I have a scientist brother, he's like, prove to me that there's a God, you know? And I said, first of all, I can't prove it, but my life is a lot better when I believe there is.
So, you know the Einstein question, is this a benevolent universe? It's a trick question. It was one of the last things he asked, so it's your choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could either believe, I absolutely found something you'd written and connected with you through what you wrote and feel that we're meant to be having this conversation now. And it's just a great feeling, because I know that that happened. Like, I know that the guy I did step work with, I was meant to have that conversation with him, and then three things happened today in order. And so I'm looking for what people term miracles, but they're not. They're universal intention. Universal intention, quantum energy, God, Hebrew meaning the word, right? Not man or sentient being or punishing figure. I'm sitting in energy. The only reason I can't see it is I'm having Amos's experience, which is a little blip,
right?
But so, not my soul, a soul, soul of the world, right? I get to be a little part of it, like a glass containing the water but surrounded by the ocean.
Right.
And so all it comes down to is, what am I going to do with this energy in the short time I have?
Right.
And I think for those of us who are blessed with the curse of alcoholism, who have found sobriety, because this is like, if I wasn't an alcoholic, I wouldn't be having this conversation.
No.
Right? We are hopefully filled with a desire to just give it to somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why I want to talk to you offline about how you do that with the 12 steps, because, you know, they apply to everything.
I know.
That's the problem.
I know. And I just think, I think that the word powerless is so misunderstood.
Agreed.
You know, I was just having this conversation with a friend of mine, and he's not sober, but his best friend is sober, and he told me that the best friend has become more of an asshole to him since he's been sober. And what this guy theorized was that he's like, I just don't like this idea of being powerless. And I sort of was like trying to explain that, but I couldn't. You know, because it's not about powerlessness.
It's about connecting to all power.
Well, yeah, because as you said, if we do this, we can do anything.
That's right.
So how are we... We're not saying we have no power.
We're saying, I believe, it's a fascinating thought process that you're on here, we're saying, until I genuinely feel humility... So a guy said to me, humility is only the understanding that all things come from God.
Wow.
Because it's really hard to define. So all it is whether it's the music or what you're writing that's coming through you, or the fact that you're not dead and you're sitting there having this conversation, like, what is it?
Right.
If I really believe that I create a talent house, I'm an idiot.
Right.
It's such a big thing with so many moving parts and brilliant people all working on it way smarter than me. What I got to do is channel the energy of the idea.
Right.
So if that, we're coming back to having this piece of energy in my experience or yours for a short period of time, what am I going to do with it? That's all
it
is.
Right.
That's all it is. Okay. So absolutely, in order to access that connectivity to everything, to the thing that spins the planet, the thing that moves the stars, the real stuff, right? The sun's going to set tonight. It's got nothing to do with me, but everything to do with me.
Right.
So in order to access that, I'm going to have to kneel down. That's the point. I'm not going to be able to get it by swinging my arms in and swaggering in and going, me and God. I'm going to have some... What's the Rumi thing? Sell all your cleverness and purchase bewilderment.
I've never heard that.
That's it. Right? Right. It's like, I cannot grasp or comprehend. If we sit down here and just begin to talk about the cosmos, we get lost in 5 minutes.
Right.
Or the other one is the opening lines of the Tao Te Ching. It's translated in different ways, but it's that, let me get this right. Okay, the nameless is the beginning of heaven and earth. The named is the mother of 10,000 things. As soon as I try and explain God, we're off.
Right.
It's lost.
Right.
But once I accept the nameless is the beginning of heaven, these things are moving around me, then your entire thing becomes, how do I connect with it? So you're right, we're not powerless.
Yeah.
We are part of a mighty, mighty force of cosmos.
Yeah.
And plugging into that, and how well you connect with that, is going to define the quality of your experience on Earth.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
So,
okay, two things.
Yeah, please.
One thing I heard in early recovery, which, from a guy I didn't even like, but I remember him saying this and me really connecting with it. He said, this really dates when I got sober. He said, I look at my VCR and I don't need to understand how it works. I don't need to know why you put a tape in and it
Brilliant.
Plays on a TV. Why would I need to understand how God works?
Brilliant.
Can't I just, you know,
accept right. it? He's absolutely right. Do you not think the real issue is the thousands of years of conditioning that God is a sentient being, or even the term he?
Right.
You know, which
right.
I'm fine with, by
it
the way.
Doesn't bother me.
But it's somewhat hilarious that the idea that the figure would be male. Why? Why would an all-knowing universal consciousness, were the Bible not written by men, who also told us that we'd given up our third rib to create women so they'd forever be in our
Yeah.
Head. Plus, if someone was trying to get someone to sin in the garden, wouldn't that be the guy? I mean, I just look
yeah.
at the way bars operate. So
yeah.
I'm being very flippant. But what I mean is, I think maybe the struggle with God is the years, thousands of years of conditioning of a punishing father figure.
Absolutely.
Whereas if you just say intelligent design, we can get to an argument about that later, you know, because everyone's like, well, is it intelligent?
Right.
It's more intelligent than me.
Yeah.
I don't put stripes on bees. I don't arrange the way things grow or die.
Right.
It's so, the synchronicity, you know,
right.
the vastness of connectivity.
Right.
I'm just fucking overjoyed to be part of it. I don't
right.
need, like you said, I don't need anyone to think, well, okay, I'm here.
Yeah.
This is it. Right?
Yeah.
This is it, right
but
now.
The challenging part is to stay connected, as you sort of alluded to.
Hence physical sobriety, the doorway.
Well, but even
the
with physical sobriety.
You got it. Only the first half of step one mentions alcohol.
Yeah.
It's not anywhere else in the other 11 steps.
Yeah.
Because the steps are steps to lead us to freedom.
Yeah.
There's one line in the book, and rocket into the fourth dimension.
Yeah.
Once.
Yeah.
What's that about? Da Vinci Code stuff. Think about it.
Right.
Why would you say that once randomly in a book written in the film? Because he knows that the fourth dimension is something that I cannot explain, but I know what it is. I had it when I was incredibly high.
Right,
and
right.
I had it today riding my bike in on the PCH, having done step work with a guy on the way, you know,
right.
looking at the ocean, feeling everything at once.
Yeah.
And I don't get that in more than milliseconds.
Right.
And I believe that the people we look to, Bodhidharma, enlightened, they lived in it. They found a way to stay there.
Right.
I'd imagine it would cause me to blow up if I lived like that.
I don't know that I would want to.
I don't think so either.
I kind of like our worldly world.
I
with,
love our world.
You know what I mean? Like,
I
like, the, you know, and that's something that I'm really inspired by you. It's like, I don't need to, you know, it, like, have this power so that I can go sit on a mountaintop.
No.
What about using
you
it to build
buzz.
Great things?
You
what about, yeah, what about, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. And that is something I will say that,
mm-hmm.
you know, I used to just think I didn't care about money at all. It was just like, you know.
I'm with you. That's another one. Keep going. Yeah.
And so, and I just was like, I just don't care. Why else would I try to be a writer? You know,
mm-hmm.
like, you can't care about money and want to be a writer.
Of course, you're an artist first. Well, that's your primary, right?
But it's the
yeah.
artist that's never... It's like just deciding to be a poet. Like, you're never... I didn't know this at the time,
mm-hmm.
but with the kind of writing I was pursuing, I was never going to get rich.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was, you know, a couple years ago where I had been through horrible work situations,
mm-hmm.
and I said, you know what? I do care about money.
Of course.
I do. I don't want to be working for people who are going to get rich off of what I do.
Well, this is a whole... Now you're in it. This is the entrepreneur thing.
Yeah.
Right? Which is... The great scam, or certainly the great illusion that I bought into, was that people knew... So everybody's smart. Let's just break this down. Secondly, everybody's stupid, right? So
right.
It's all quotes, I know, but the, you know, the man who knows he knows nothing, which is... I hope it's Socrates or Plato. It's one of the two of them. It's huge,
right?
Right? you go into a recording studio with an amazing artist and they blow you away, and you go to Silicon Valley and you sit with a young tech guy, obviously I based out there when I first moved to the States to build a company, and they blow you away.
Yeah.
But you take that person and you put them on a city block on a street corner and they can't get out.
Yeah.
Or you take the musician and you put them in a rocket science lab and he doesn't know what's happening. So knowledge is specialist and selective.
Right.
So one of the first things I bought into that was erroneous is that people really knew what they were doing. We're all bluffing.
Right.
Really big people, and I know really big people, yeah, like massive, are bluffing.
Yeah.
They're still figuring it out. They're still working out what they're doing. So now this opens a whole new door for us and our listeners, right?
Yeah.
You can do absolutely anything.
Yeah.
And it's an illusion that you have to get to a certain place to do it.
Yeah.
So the people that break through those illusions, the Steve Jobs, the Bill Gates, the Bob Marleys, the Bob Dylans, are people that just follow their path. They're like, yeah, I'm doing this.
Yeah.
The second part of what you said, and the second part of my sobriety, which may sound strange, is Tony Robbins, Anthony Robbins.
Right.
Huge influence.
Have
on
you
my
done
life.
Those seminars?
Well, I've done all the written work way before I got sober.
Yeah.
I did all the books, which helped me get sober, and yeah, I used the personal power CD thing, I think you can get on iPads now, for 3 years on repeat. I mean, I can, wow, pretty much quote them. Transformational human being. One of the things he says at the beginning is, if you're reading this and you're looking for something of your reasonable intelligence, and you, for example, are clearly intelligent, that's a given, then you should have financial independence. This is, yeah, really interesting.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, why wouldn't you? What's the point of being really smart,
right,
but being really broke? It's like, well, you, right, haven't used that part of your mind correctly, because,
right,
money is energy, and what money does is buy you time. That's it.
Right.
All kinds of time. Amazing experiences, or just time. I,
right,
don't want to do that.
Right.
I want to pause. How can I help that person? And recently, with the turn of events with great philanthropists, the Warren Buffetts, you know, I read yesterday that Bill Gates is vaccinating, I said, 850,000 children a week.
Jesus.
People are like, oh, he's evil. Really?
Yeah.
What did you do today?
Yeah.
What,
yeah,
have I done? I gave you guys 10 bucks outside.
Yeah.
The ability to help,
yeah,
which is generated by the creation of wealth as well, and do things. So you should feel nothing except a relaxed sense of mission towards finance in the same way as you do to your psychological well-being.
Right.
Or I want to keep my body fit. I,
right,
want to make money to live. It's all good.
Yeah.
You must take away that artist thing, which I grew up with.
I,
which,
know,
is, I'm a pure artist and I can't, you know, it's like...
But
know.
I didn't think like that.
No,
I didn't even, I wasn't,
yeah,
even practical enough to think like that. But also, I know so many smart writers,
uh-huh,
who are broke.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
partly
many.
Partly why we built talent now. So I agree that there's not enough opportunity for the creative.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we live in the greatest period for creativity since the Renaissance because of the internet, right?
Yeah.
Although it seems like chaos at the moment, anyone can make anything. And now you're seeing Maker Studio and you know, to a division of Instagram. But also, I just met with an animation group that are crowdsourcing huge movies with blocks from animators from all over the world and then vetting them and putting them into... You know, this is an amazing time. The,
yeah,
stuff we're talking about is totally impossible, right?
Yeah.
And what you've done, and the whole idea of correlating writers and blogs, and this is all new. I mean,
yeah,
we're all relaxed about it, right? It didn't exist 10 years ago.
I know.
Nothing.
I know.
So I think the potential for the creatives to actually... Talent House's model is to be seen, be heard, be compensated. We use brand-sponsored capital to pay the creative community.
But not writers who write articles and,
well,
books.
Well, interestingly, you should say that. It's difficult because it's not a visual medium, so that's much better for... BuzzFeed and all of that stuff, you know what I mean? Or,
yeah,
HuffPost.
They keep yeah, the writers broke too. HuffPost doesn't even pay anybody.
I know. So,
so
now you've got a huge thing. Go ahead. Go,
yeah,
on. Yeah.
So, oh wait, but I was going to say something so important about...
I was going to say you should start an alternative HuffPost that pays writers, because
I think
your
I
position.
Have, but it's only,
yeah,
addiction and recovery.
Okay, so now you need to
much.
Open it up.
Yeah. To what?
To writing about anything. You're already there. You just nailed the problem, because you're right.
It's probably bigger though.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's a scale thing. You know, there's,
yeah,
this great article,
uh-huh,
out there that Kevin Kelly, who started Wired Magazine,
yes,
wrote, and it's called 1,000 True Fans.
Uh-huh.
And it basically says, as a creative person, you don't have to be famous,
mm-hmm,
to make a great living.
Mm-hmm.
All you need is 1,000 people who
Good
will
point.
Buy everything
Good point.
You do.
Good point.
And I've got about 6.
Right.
So I've got a way to go.
No. But also, you must be caught in quite a difficult dilemma, which is that I've spoken with you, and I know you have genuine humility. I can hear it. We talked about other things
right,
outside
right.
of this. And the dilemma is you have to promote yourself, and it's very hard.
Oh, I'm so into promoting myself. I mean, Make no mistake.
You should be at big AA conferences, surely talking about this to 2,000 people and saying, this is what I do, and do you want to help me do it?
Yeah, that's complicated. Ah, no. They don't let you do that. AA's got... Because it runs so well. Who am I to say they should let people go in and promote websites? No.
I hear where you're going. I just think that we started on this way back, right? How many people do you know who are not in the program who understand the 12-step program? None.
Nobody, yeah.
Right? But the 12-step program is shortened enlightenment. It would benefit anyone. If you replace the words... We admit we were powerless over alcohol or drinking with thinking. We admit we were powerless over our thinking and our lives have become unmanageable. You get the human condition.
I know.
And I feel like we're not given it. It's like, no. I do this with pretty much everyone I meet. Like, right. One way or another, right. We end up talking about a very...
Do they get it?
They want it.
Yeah.
They don't just get it. They're like, how do I do this?
Well, this is what I see as the major problem.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
That you won't do these radical things until
you're
in so much pain.
But a lot of people are in pain. They're just not in pain.
They're not in so much
pain.
Agree.
Well, you're talking about the premise of revolution. There's never a revolution until people are starving.
Yeah.
Then everyone always says we should change the government. It only happens in history when people are literally dying in the street.
I won't change my behavior until I'm absolutely miserable over it.
You know what? You are so right. And it's okay. Look, I'm not smart enough to solve this problem. I do know that more people would benefit from access to the 12 steps.
I know.
I'm clear
about
it.
I know. It's like you can get the whole world to do yoga. I mean, at least a lot of the world.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like... I'll tell you something.
Mm.
Party Girl, when I first wrote it, when I first got notes from my editor, who was lovely, she said, you got to take the God stuff out. And I said, fine, I don't care.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then, whatever, 2 years later, a book, you know, causes a sensation called Eat, Pray, Love.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So then I'm like, that had pray in the title.
All the way through.
That's the problem with book publishing is nobody knows anything, truly.
It's the same, a lot of the creative industries like that.
Except,
a high level, it's a lot gut. Right?
Except there's no tracking. You know, it's the only creative business where literally there's no, whatever you call it, like, what do they call, you know,
surveying
or whatever.
Oh, I know what you mean, like marketing, tracking, and group testing. And
nothing.
Just out there.
They just throw a bunch out there, and then suddenly... Eat, Pray, Love gets on Oprah, and it's whatever.
Yeah.
By the way, what Elizabeth Gilbert says about creativity keeps you... I've thought of it several times while you've talked, because while I wasn't crazy for that book, she has a TED Talk where she talks exactly that she's not a genius, that this...
Connectivity.
I'm going to send you the email.
I'd love to see it.
Yeah, I'm going to send you the link.
I'd love
it's a fascinating talk.
I mean, the funny thing is that the more you push towards that idea in yourself, because obviously you can say it out loud, it makes you sound like... In my case, it's like, oh, I'm really humble. It's not.
Right.
It's the more I think, I get this all the time, you know. I think I had it today at one point. I was walking towards, you know, I love cars and bikes. And I used to race all that stuff. And I was walking towards a bike. And I had a moment where I was like, yeah. And as soon as I feel like, I was like, hang on a minute. God, right?
Yeah.
First of all, what am I doing here? I'm on the west coast of America. Going to have this beautiful ride into this building where people can sit around talking about how to redefine the product and the offering we're doing, because I'm taking it to companies that I used to dream about talking to. Where am I in all this?
Right.
And the answer is, I'm not the guy swaggering.
Right.
And it's very difficult for me because, my early years I was raised by Jamaicans, and swagger is what we do, right? You know what I mean? The whole thing is like, wow, you know what I mean? Move out of the way and I'm coming through. And there's a beauty to that too, and it's fun. But it's not real. The truth is,
You think that possibly? I mean, there's no humble way to answer this question. But the reason for a lot of your success is that you can combine the swagger with the humility.
Yes, and let me say that, because again, it makes me say this is very difficult to say. Yeah, okay. The swagger I don't even know I have. That's the weird thing. So the other day I went somewhere to another place, and they were like, I walk stupidly. I'm not aware I'm walking stupidly, right? They're like, why do you walk like that? So the point is, yes, that I was raised in a certain part of culture, very separate from mine, from my mother and father's, who were basically intellectuals.
Right.
And it was beautiful, and it was expressive and soulful and very physical.
Right.
And language, the second language we all spoke was music.
Right.
That's what I realized early on. My foster brothers, who were all older than me, my father and mother split, and they moved into my house, actually into my bedroom. There were like three or four of them, and they were like 15 to 19 when I was like 10, and obviously I'd worked this out since then, was looking for a father figure because my dad had gone.
Right.
And they were, what they did is they talked in music, so everyone was very tough and physical. I was like a skinny little kid. A couple of them were from remand centres. They were those guys, right, from the projects. But they played music the way they talked to each other. There was always music playing. And a lot of it was real soft and beautiful and funky and soulful and what's going on. Early Studio One reggae music. And it's actually very emotional. And that language was the language that we all spoke, that I still speak. This is my second language, is definitely music.
Right.
You know, it's how I relate to everything. It's how I think of things. And so encapsulated in that, in the inner cities, is dancing and fighting and physical expressions, you know what I mean? Which basically are all you have. Looking back at it now, I'm like, that's what you are, right? You're what you wear, you're how you move, and there's a degree of risk in those neighborhoods, and you know, it all ties into one sort of thing. So, yes, the gift they gave me, and I would not be building a collective for artists, not for these people. I wouldn't understand that they were more talented than me and that I got a break because of Boy George, which was luck or God, and I wouldn't understand. But, you know, honestly, the talent that I grew up with, some of it, Nick Knight, John Galliano, those guys took over, George, the Blitz lot, you know what I mean?
Right.
They were amazing. And Barry would sort of endorse them, and there was all of that. And then the other side, which is sort of the African-European experience I had with projects, you know, most of those guys, not all of them, but a lot of them were decimated by crack cocaine and would never, you know, when you live in that environment, you don't think you're ever coming out. You don't think about being out. You don't know what out is. When you see kids killing each other over a corner, it's because they believe that corner is the universe. And I lived where I thought that corner was the universe. You know, when I was little, it was important to me to not be a bitch and to not punk out. And so you know, I carried a knife. I was like 13.
Right.
You know, but that's... And I was terrified.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, all those guys, my brothers and sisters who were there, they're terrified.
Right.
You know, the gangster thing is a whole other conversation. It's an illusion.
Well, that's like... I mean, this is not really the same thing, but it's... You know, when I see people all tatted up with sleeves, I think, oh, you're telling me you're scared.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
That's what they're telling me.
That's so beautiful.
Because why else would you do
body art? I'm not a big tat guy, but I get it. It's
I don't know. I think you'd put art somewhere besides all over your body. This is just my opinion. Nobody agrees with me, possibly.
No, I think that tattoos are a really personal thing. Coming from a different place, I've got a small one that took me like 10 years. I put one when I was 20 something years old. I wouldn't do another one. I was really tempted to put Serenity on my chest after a few years, but then I thought, that's really tempting fate, right? You're going to, at some point, you may be stumbling around looking at Serenity.
Yeah.
But I think tattoos are really personal. It's not for me. Anything that permanent is a different deal. However, I think it looks really beautiful, and you look at someone. I just watched this. I'm just thinking about tattoos because I watched this. And if you saw the documentary with David Beckham about his trip, it's really good. He came over so well.
Yeah.
And it was like something I would never watch. It's like, why would I watch this? But it was really interesting. It was about celebrity.
Yeah.
Really, and his desire to go somewhere, to get out of. Interesting that he took a camera crew with him, but it's worth seeing.
Yeah.
You see it.
Well, you know what's the most interesting documentary I've ever seen about celebrity was that one with the backup singers.
Oh, that's great. 20 feet from Stardom.
Like, when they had Bruce Springsteen and Sting talking,
and
you're like, wow, that's what celebrities can sound like if they're not talking about themselves.
Yeah.
They sounded like the most beautiful, loving.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying maybe the two of them are the most beautiful, loving
people.
We
picked a good one. I mean, Springsteen, I think Bruce Springsteen is an enigma, right? He's the real thing. Now, I saw him recently and I was thinking, apart from being amazed as usual, there's not really anyone like him left. I mean, he is a guy that comes on in jeans and a shirt. And how is he? Is he 60?
Maybe. I don't know.
It's phenomenal energy. And commune with the crowd, and he has this ability to talk to 20,000 people like it's 10 people, which is really difficult. I spent a lot of time on stages when I was at a lot, like thousands of gigs. It's hard. It's easy to go to everybody, can't raise your hand. It's very difficult to tell anecdotes to 20,000 people, and you think he's talking to you, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think he's a phenomenal writer. The whole Ghost of Tom Joad, link to Steinbeck, you know, the whole album that he did, it was and his links to that book in everything he does, and the Great American Struggle. And now, I'm getting caught up in wonder. I'm always amazed we live in this world,
right?
And these people exist.
Yeah, I know. But, okay, question though.
Yes, of course.
So you got in Culture Club. Sorry, we're going.
So I should clear that up.
Yeah.
I'm glad you asked that. No, what happened was George invited me to work with a band when they were very new, because one, the guy that had kids with my sister, Mikey, is the nephew that I talked about,
yeah,
who later died. He formed a band with George. He's a bass player.
Okay.
So that's how it started. And then I looked really weird. This is 1980, 81. I had dreadlocks. I was 12, 13.
Mm-hmm.
I actually got a picture somewhere. I'll show you so you can see it. But I looked like a freak.
Right.
I didn't, you know, and then that was the time in England before festivals and crusties and all that stuff. So there was me.
Right.
As a white guy with dreadlocks. That was
yeah.
it, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
literally me. And we spent a lot of time running away from skinheads. That's what I remember about the period. So George asked me to work with a band. They were new. And we did. I did a lot of the early modelling stuff with them. All the stuff for the face and ID. Mainly because I looked like a freak. I want to be clear. I just looked
but
very...
But you
weird.
Sang on
I sang
songs.
In Jamaican on the first album with a really high voice. Captain Crucial. God, I didn't talk about that. And I did the first three singles. And then my mother... had a bit of a breakdown when she was pardoned during this court case to do with the refugees, and moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and took me
yeah.
3 weeks before they released Do You Wanna Hurt Me.
Oh, wow.
So I was sitting in the desert in Santa Fe, no black people, just me, and like no peers, no nothing, and they dropped that record, and it went to number one in like 50 countries.
Right.
And so what was great in the end was... Firstly, I got an amazing education in New Mexico. That's where I met Native Americans and started reading the Tao Te Ching, kind of woke up.
Right, right.
Because I was a little hood rat. And secondly, when I got back, George was so successful that he got me a record deal.
Right,
that
right.
was the story. I came
yeah.
back and he was like, put me in with Richard Branson. And
right.
this is my kid.
Yeah.
And we got signed on like an awful demo. It was great. It was the 80s. And I gave us loads of money and I got the biggest shoulder pads. Like, I mean, really big. Like, you
that was more. In the article.
Yeah,
I think.
Huge. Like, Anthony Price. Remember all the Duran stuff?
Oh,
this,
do
those
I?
Are
yeah.
the same designer. They're
yeah.
like, literally, you have to go sideways through doors. We look ridiculous. And, you know, I thought we were just the best thing. And I was... a complete dickhead. I mean, I'm still a dickhead now, but then I was a
don't
really
that.
Pure ass. You know,
right.
I was just so like, of course, this is my destiny.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm going to do this.
But you never had to lose it all.
Yeah, 3 or 4 times.
Really?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, the first one was. How much time do you have, by the way?
Well, no, it's you.
On?
Yeah, no, but I was told you only had an hour. So,
I mean,
so
let's
we
go
got.
For a little bit more.
Well, you just got to think about how we're coming to the end. We don't have to end.
Well, I'll tell you what, in terms of losing it all, I've always lost it all. So, this is the thing.
Really?
That I mean, really, really. Like, I signed at 16, 17, and I was signed till I was probably 19 or 20, which meant I never had a job.
Yeah.
Right? And then I had my only job. I got dropped. I remember when the label dropped me. I was so shocked.
Yeah.
Why did they drop me? I had sold me records. I mean,
right.
I was a total monster. We spent fortune, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on making records. We had Hugh Masekela with us and Brenda Russell and the London. And my grandiosity knew no bounds.
Right.
Right? I was like, you know, I'm going to do this. And so then I got a job for about 6 months. In a sports shop. It's the only job I've ever had, selling shoes.
Nice.
And all the guys that I was a dick to in my neighbourhood would
walked
come
in,
put their
shoes.
Foot down and be like, get me a size 8.
Yeah.
They'd never buy them either. I'd have to put them on.
Right.
And then I'd cut a record with George called Everything I Own, which was a comeback single for him. And they were playing it on the radio. It was a hit. And a guy came in from another band to get shoes. And he saw me. And the guy said, it's him on the radio. And I was
yeah.
like, shut up. I was like hiding. And this guy from the other band looked at me and said, what are you doing here? And so I walked out and I formed a band with Ringo Starr's son, with Zach
yes,
Starkey.
Yeah.
Right. And we spent maybe 2 years writing demos, and that was where I really started to learn to be a musician. And Ringo had a house with a recording studio in it, and he was so good to me. He was like, you want to use the studio, use it.
Yeah.
So I went from being an entitled signed little monster to go riding my broken 125cc motorcycle up to this house out in the middle of nowhere every day. And studying the desk and learning. And so over time, we built it up and we signed in Japan and we became a very bad rock band, leather pants, Harleys, the whole deal, drinking habit. That's why we really started to drink. And then I got pneumonia and I nearly died and I did 5 days of that. And then I came out of that and it was Acid House. It was 1988. George
right.
actually called me. George kept him in hospital. I hadn't seen him for ages. And he was like, you should be doing this. And I was like, I'm like a rap guy, man.
Yeah.
We have like big arrangements and a full-scale band. And he was like, no, listen to this. And then I went to one of the first acid house clubs called The Trip in London in 1988 on acid, mm-hmm. which is something that we never did, right? You did acid and went out in nature.
Yeah.
I was like, what are we doing? And I had the epiphany. It was like, wow, everyone was together. And it was amazing. It was like thousands of people. So then I went on that route, and then I built that up and lost that. And then I built... So yes, to answer your question, all of them have gone like this.
Yeah.
I haven't managed to stay in this yet.
But since you've been sober...
Totally different.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally different. Because I think of what we talked about, I've always felt a huge sense of gratitude.
Yeah.
Drunk or sober, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't this exciting? But I definitely didn't have the humility that I'm working on practicing now, which is where when you get great things, you don't have to throw them away, right? Or give them all away. You could just sit with them and let them be great.
And you can remember that it's the universe's gift to you and not how,
Not an entitled thing. And it's hard, right? You'd slip all the time.
All the time.
And so a good example is, you talked earlier, we were talking about dating and standards.
Yeah.
Firstly, you're absolutely right. I've become really old-fashioned in the way that I view masculinity.
Yeah.
A lot of the step work goes back to the original Christian stuff, and a lot of that is linked to the Knights Templar, who also did terrible things, but some of their stuff, like, you know, the tenants... protect the helpless, always tell the truth even if it shouldn't mean your death, do good and be upstanding so that God may love you. Those three things, so protect the helpless, always tell the truth and do good.
Yeah.
You know, this idea of being a knight links to the way a man behaves.
Yeah.
So it's not just holding a chair or pulling a door, it's seeing a woman as sacred.
Right.
So what I'm talking about is, you were just talking about gratitude and humility, it's bringing that into, for example, if you're sitting across the table from someone in a restaurant, you are really aware of how beautiful this moment is.
Right.
And I think that we need almost a return to that kind of thing, you know what I mean? The opposite of I have a jet or I'm a badass. I'm more like, isn't this amazing I get to spend this time with you?
But don't you think that's the human struggle, is that we're not built like that. And so that's
the animal part.
We're just not. I mean, humans are not like that.
Yeah, I think the problem is we got this. This is like that, isn't it? And this isn't.
Yeah.
So we're both things.
He's pointing, by the way, to different parts of
his
head.
Oh, good God, I'm glad you said that. Yes, I was saying we have cortex and midbrain. What did you call it
earlier?
Limbic's the actual correct term. Thank you. And so reptilian brainstem, millions of years old. Right?
Yeah.
So, and the point is, the reason, God, I'm going to take a jump here. The reason we are chosen, and let's be clear, we're chosen, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have Mozart and architecture and politics, so we're clearly chosen. We can all go, no, you know, I love animals, but, you know, dolphins have what we had, they probably have tower blocks, right? Let's be honest.
Right.
No, they're happy with that. All right, but they don't have this, which is, what is this? Choice.
Yeah.
Free will. It's one word. Why?
Right.
That's it.
Right.
The ability to ask why. So you're right when you say, aren't humans just like this? I'm now pointing at limbic.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, no, aren't they like this? Cortex. But you're right, they're both.
Yeah.
So we come back to step work, to condition my frontal cortex to
control
the impulses of my limbic brain, which lead to things like chivalry, compassion, empathy, service, ultimately to put things before myself, for it is by self-forgetting that one finds and finds it.
Which
the
is my favorite favorite line of my favorite prayer.
So I say that prayer every morning.
I should.
It's amazing, because whenever I'm pissed, and I'm usually pissed in the morning, I start with, Lord, make me a channel of thy peace. I mean, what a thing to do. It's like, what can I be? Can I be peace?
Right.
Not can Lord can I have more money, or Lord, you know, or Lord just make me a dude. Like, what's he say? Grant thou mercy. What's the one for whatever is wrong? You obviously assume he's going to say, I may bring righteousness, but I may bring the spirit of forgiveness. This is word for word some of the most beautiful writing ever written. And then he says, for it is by self-forgetting that one finds.
It is by forgetting.
Yeah.
No, forgiving.
For self-forgetting that one finds. It's by forgiving that one is forgiven. It's by dying that one awakens to another life. I assume the ego.
Yeah.
It's by dying that one awakens to another life. But grant them, I seek to comfort rather than be comforted, to understand rather than... It's amazing.
Yeah.
But the line, for it is by self-forgetting that one finds, could have come from Freud. That's what I find amazing. It was like so far back.
Yeah.
You know, and so articulate and perfect.
Yeah.
And we have... And you're right, in terms of time, I'm just trying to think about it.
We have an
opportunity, right?
Yes.
The opportunity is to practice this. And in practicing this, everything else will happen around it.
Yeah.
And without practicing it, nothing else will matter.
Yeah.
So I think that's really where we came in, right?
Yes, what a perfect, how perfectly brought full circle. I love it.
Yeah, so wow, do you feel like we just kind of went to the mountaintop and got zen? That's sort of how I feel. What an inspiring guy. You heard it from him. We can do anything. Yeah. Hey, Miss Pizzy, After Party Pod.